You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And Don, it was 82 degrees yesterday. I'm so excited until I thought it's going to be 59.
I have to tell you two very amusing comments that were made. One was someone who replied to a notification about a special order. Oh, I'm sorry. The planting window is closing, she said.
What?
Yeah, that's kind of how we reacted. And the other was someone complaining about how hot it was. So you know that you're in California when 82 degrees causes someone to complain about how hot it is. We're recording this for broadcast on March 27th. We're recording it on March 26th, 2025 for broadcast on March 27th, 2025. Weather right now, late morning, as we are on the whatever you call this, Zoom that we're attempting to make this show on, 57 degrees here, going up to a high today of 68. What was it yesterday? 82. Today, 68. Tonight, 54.
82.
Yeah, 82. Tonight, today, 68. Tonight, 54. So that's good. Increasing clouds, which means cloud cover is going to keep a little warmth in for those of you champing at the bit for your summer vegetables and flowers. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 64 degrees. And oh, look, a chance of showers. Thursday night, 50 degrees and a chance of showers. Friday, 63, chance of showers. So let's see, 82 on Tuesday, 63 on Friday. Friday night, 41. It's an important data point. Partly cloudy. Saturday, 64 and sunny. That should be gorgeous. Saturday night, 46. Mostly cloudy. Chance of showers. Sunday, 59 degrees. I can't really get the extended forecast to open, but at least we know that on Monday, there's also a chance of showers. 64 degrees. Monday night, 47 degrees. Tuesday, 62 degrees. What do you think most of our conversations at our garden center have been about for the last couple of days, Lois?
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
Okay. We have various metrics that we use. Whichever one is convenient to you. Well, we've hit a couple of them because, you know, we use night temperature, daytime temperature, soil temperature. And of course, we look at the weather forecast. So 82 degrees. Well, one of the things I do like to say to people who are really, really anxious in, let's say, January or early February, when we've hit 80 degrees once or twice, you can think about planting tomatoes. What about the night temperatures? Well, 50. To me, as a retailer, I really don't want to bring in tomato plants when it's getting into the 40s at night. If I do, I have to put them, in my opinion, for your quality, into the greenhouse overnight. And that's kind of a hassle, but that's what we've been doing. We have not gotten below 50 for the last couple of nights. Okay, great. So 80 degrees,
but we're going to
50 degrees. There's a couple metrics right there. How about that soil temperature we always like to talk about? Basic minimum soil temperature I'm looking for tomatoes is 60 degrees. It's gone up.
Well, it's not even close.
It's gotten up to 53. 54. So it's moving up. It's getting there. So here's the thing, folks. If you really want to plant a tomato plant now, I'm not going to stop you. Go for it, but be aware of a couple things. One, you're putting them in as we go into somewhat colder weather again, somewhat more normal temperatures. That 41 degrees a couple mornings from now, well, the tomato plant will not be killed by it. It might turn purplish. It will certainly not be growing, but it probably won't be harmed by it at this point. As we get close to the 1st of April, we've got a lot of people that always want to plant their tomatoes in mid-March, late March, and they do this and they're prepared. This is the important part, to cover them, not for frost protection, not because I'm worried about the likelihood of frost. I mean, that's happened, but that's increasingly unlikely as we go obviously further into April. I'm more concerned about the effect of cold temperature on the young plant that's out there. So if you have some frost blanket or a little hot caps, anybody remember the little hot cap devices you would put over your tomato plant? Or you've got a 1 gallon milk jug plastic thing that you can cut the bottom off of, set that over it, whatever it takes to make the air and especially the soil temperature around that little plant a little warmer, as we happen to have colder ups and downs in the temperatures, you can get it through. About 5 weeks ago, took home some young tomato seedlings that we had at our nursery. We started some very early, and I took home a couple batches of them. I have a pop-up greenhouse, and I have open tables. And I put half of them in the pop-up greenhouse and half of them on the open tables. And of course, we've been down rather cold at night over the last 4 weeks. We've had what I would consider normal cold night temperatures. The ones in the greenhouse immediately stopped growing because pop-up greenhouses don't stay that warm at night, but they make a few degrees difference. So those plants stayed green. They just stopped growing completely. They just sat there. They looked exactly the same today as they did 4 weeks ago when I put them in there. The ones out on the open table immediately turned kind of purple. We know that that's a phosphorus deficiency. We know that's an internal nutrient deficiency that you cannot correct. It's a cold weather related phenomenon. They also did not grow. They are sitting there, and both are sitting inside and outside the greenhouse. As the nights have warmed up, the ones in the little pop-up greenhouse have just begun to initiate some new growth. The ones outside the pop-up greenhouse have not done so yet. They would be more akin to the ones you're putting out in your garden. So early planting would certainly have gained nothing 3 or 4 weeks ago and could have harmed the plant. Now we're at the stage where, and this goes for many of your flowers, you know, impatiens, things like that, they would not probably be killed outright. We're not going to get a frost. We're not even getting into the 30s, but 40, 41 degrees is definitely colder than subtropical and tropical plants would prefer. So go ahead and do it if you want. You're anxious. You got this weekend to do the project. It's sunny. You've got the family. You're going down to the garden center. Feel free to buy plants. Don't hesitate to buy things from me and any other garden center in the area if you so choose. What I would personally do with those is take them and put them in a nice sheltered location near your house. Then go out and put some compost down on the bed where you're going to plant them and make sure your irrigation system is working correctly. And make notes about the other things you're going to want to buy later that you really shouldn't buy this early, such as peppers, eggplant, squash, melons, okra, cucumbers, all those kinds of things. Tomatoes, go ahead and buy them. Put them in that sheltered location. If you've got peppers and those other things I just rattled through, they probably still need to be in a more sheltered place at night. You can, if you wish, plant beans right now. Green beans do go in very successfully late March, early April. That's the short answer to the most common question we're getting at garden centers all over Northern California with this unusually, emphasis on unusually, warm weather we've had for the last couple of days. Shouldn't be as hard to have that conversation on Friday when the high is going to be, what did I just say?
59.
Yeah. So a little easier to explain when people are still wearing three layers and looking for tomato plants. Okay. So that's the weather. Let's do one of those PSAs. Go ahead.
Okay. So do you want gardening books? There's a lot of gardening books at every library sale. And the weekend, which includes the first Friday of each month, has the Friends of the Davis Library book sale on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It's at the County Library at 14th Street here in Davis. And you can volunteer if you want to help set up on Thursday before the sale. Anyway, it's coming up. I went to the library, the friendsofthelibrary.org website, and they list all the sales coming up. So if you want to put them on your calendar, go ahead. But for this time, April 4th through 6th is Friday is noon to 7, Saturday is 10 to 5, and Sunday is 10 to 3.
Okay. And of course, the Arboretum has their very popular sales coming up. And the next one is on April 6th. That's a Sunday. Split plant sale, as they call it. Split meaning that members only can come at 9 o'clock and shop from 9 to 10. And all the rest of you are welcome to come in 10 a.m. to 1, or you can become a member to shop early and save. You get a little discount as a member. Next sale, Sunday, April 6th. Just keep in mind, if you go to arboretum.ucdavis.edu, shortly before the sale, they post an inventory of what's there. So you can make some plans and scramble around the other several thousand people who are there trying to find the plants you want. April 6th, there's a couple more coming up later, and of course, we'll mention them as we go along.
I also want to tell you about the UC Davis Honey and Pollination Center. It's a showcase of importance of honey pollination and bee health into the well-being of everybody. The center is located at the Mondavi Institute on the UC Davis campus, and you can get lots more information by visiting their website, honey.ucdavis.edu. Now, I did go there, and the thing that there's lots of information, but the thing that I liked most is if you click on that tab that says learn, it will show you resources of lots of different places. You know, they've got the Bohart Museum of Entomology and the Master Beekeepers Program and all this other stuff. So lots of information. If you like bees and you like honey, this is the place to go.
Lots of things you can plant in this area for bees. And there is a cool garden out there. The what's the official name of that garden? It's on here.
Somewhere. I just closed that.
Okay. Well, anyway, there's the bee garden. It's out as you head out of campus towards the Primate Center and off to your left. Very cool garden.
It's near the airport. If you can find the UC airport, it's on that road.
Yeah, not the Sacramento airport.
No, UC Davis airport. It's a little tiny thing. It's about that big.
Okay, let's see. We keep getting questions about what to plant when. So we've obviously talked about tomatoes. What we can plant right now is beans, beets, carrots. You can still plant potatoes, and you can do radishes. And you can still do green onions and things like that. I got a lot of people coming in looking for leafy greens, and we're at an interesting time of year. I'm done with brassicas, that is to say the kale and the cabbage and the broccoli and all that kind of stuff. If you have them, people are posting pictures on a local Facebook group of their broccolini flowering. And it's kind of, what do I do now? We said, pick it and eat it really fast because that's what you're growing it for. And some of those leafy greens will continue. I do have customers who do very dense plantings of lettuce, for example. They'll buy six packs, put the plants in 6 to 8 inches apart, let them grow for just a few weeks and harvest. You can continue that right on through April. But you'll find we're at that odd time of year where some things just initiate flowering and you better harvest them or you're done with them. Personally, when my brassicas go into flower, I let them flower because I think the flowers are pretty and they draw bees and other beneficials. So I just let them bloom and become part of the ornamental landscape. But you can still plant some leafy greens. You can do beets for the leaves. I used to wonder why people were buying beet plants from me. It seems like you would direct seed beets, right? Because you're growing them for the root. And I have a lot of people, one, who don't like to direct seed anything because they just don't get good results. And two, they weren't growing them for the beets. They're growing them for the beet greens. Okay, well, that's easy. You can even crowd them in a container if you want to do that. If you're not concerned about the size of the beets themselves and you're just growing them for the leafy greens, which are very good for you, then you can plant them pretty much anytime. And you can plant beets for beets anytime, but they need more space. They can't be super crowded. In one plant I sell year-round and I sell at least a flat or two a week is Swiss chard. Always amazes me how much Swiss chard I sell, but I've got to say it's one of the easiest vegetables to grow. You can plant it any time of year here in Northern California. If it starts to bolt, just cut it back and new stuff will come from the base and you can harvest that anytime. So it's just got to be one of the easiest vegetables by far. All those things you're thinking of, tomatoes, basil, corn, cucumber, squash, those come later as we discussed earlier. So we'll just try to update you each time.
So you talked about beets and you talked about Swiss chard. Aren't those the same? I remember when we were in a class and I was looking at the beet seeds and I was looking at the Swiss chard seeds. I couldn't tell the difference. And somebody said, oh, well, that's the same species. It's just a different variation. And I wasn't sure if that was true or not. Is that true?
They're closely related.
Closely related.
Swiss chard is just super easy to grow. I don't know what, you know, everybody does with it. It's one of those somewhat stringy, stemmy vegetables. It's a little on the tough side, but you can chop it into soups and stews and your family will be none the wiser.
And the other thing you mentioned was you mentioned the brassicas. Is mustard a part of the brassica family?
Oh, yes.
Family?
That's probably the best known one. And it's blooming all over California right now.
If you are getting out of your house and into your car and driving into the countryside, you'll see that yellow, probably knee-high plant.
Yeah, mostly this year.
In most places. Yeah. Bright yellow. And then right next to it will be some that's white with a little lavender color in it. And that's radish. And those are the two.
It's true. We also have a white mustard, interestingly. So yes, we have wild radishes. We have mustard. There's a white flowered radish, a mustard. The predominant one in the area is the non-native mustard. It was introduced probably by the missionaries back in the 1700s. And it is the most widespread invasive plant in California. It's spectacularly beautiful. Some people have trouble looking at fields of mustard and thinking anything other than, oh, it's invasive. The rest of us are going, hey, look at those red-winged blackbirds that are in there. Because it is very attractive. extract of the many beneficials. I actually use mustard when it comes up on my farm as a, in combination with oats, as a very, very effective cover crop for crowding out any weeds. It really is effective for that. Regrettably, it also crowds out any native grasses. So I have an area on my property that was California native grasses when we bought the place, and we've worked really hard to retain them. And the main invaders into that area have always been the oats and the mustard. So I can tell you one thing I've learned is the timing of my mowing. Going out there and mowing the oats and the mustard and leaving and mowing around the native grasses has made it possible for the, I've been here for 40 years, and I've managed to retain about a half acre of predominantly native grasses. Had I not done so, with that rather careful timing of mowing, it would be solid oats and mustard over those areas. I don't mind them growing, especially I like them growing where I'm going to have vegetables, because it actually makes a really effective mulch when you just chop it down and spread it around your vegetables. They're both vigorous. They're both tall, and they definitely outcompete more problematic weeds. The reason I actually like them on my farm is they will outcompete foxtails. And so in areas where I've had foxtails, I will use the oats and the mustard to smother or choke it out. And it does work for that purpose. But unfortunately, if you're trying to grow native grasses, those are very challenging. The size and height, you mentioned it's about knee high this year. Yes, that's entirely related to the timing and the amount of rain we get. So I've had years where both mustard and oats were 5 feet plus on my farm. One year they were above my head when we had 30 inches of rainfall and it continued into the spring. More typical, the pattern is we get a good rain that germinates them. We get rain at intervals that keeps them growing, and most of them top out 3 to 4 feet. Higher than our native grasses, regrettably, and higher than our native wildflowers, but high enough to give a very solid cover. But you can still walk through them, although your dog running behind you may be lost in the grass, you at least can walk through them. In a wet year, they are shoulder high, and I'm over 6 feet tall. So we can have years where the biomass produced by these non-native adventive plants, favorite term, can be surprisingly big.
And mustard is one of those things that if you have a rural property and you have a stand of mustard that's doing real well this winter, before you go to cut it down, just check and make sure that it's not housing the red-winged blackbirds.
It's pretty easy and to check. Just sit there.
wait a couple weeks. Yeah. Wait a couple weeks and the birds will fledge out and fly away, and then fine, no problem. But people sometimes aren't very aware.
Yeah, they actually love to nest in there, and you can see them. You can tell where their nests are because I'm assuming it's the mama bird is sitting on top of a mustard plant right nearby. So she'll let you know if you're coming.
No, Don. The mama bird has woven a nest hanging from the mustard plant about halfway up, and mama bird is in there with the babies.
So I'm seeing papa bird.
It's the papa bird that's up on top declaring his superiority to every other bird in the country. Oh, I'm so great. I'm wonderful.
Look out for that biped over there.
Red epaulets on his shoulder. Yep.
All right. We have lots of questions today. All kinds of stuff to talk about. What do we got?
So Ben writes to us, who's from San Fernando Valley in Southern California. It's spring. Also, I love beans. I was wondering what y'all think about using powder inoculation of legumes in the garden. I thought mycorrhiza and the other microbes that the plant need were already in the soil. Is there a benefit to adding this powder? Or conversely, is it possible to negatively disrupt native soil by microbial ecosystems by introducing factory produced competitors? Perhaps these guys are pretty universal and the natives just always have the home niche advantage. Thank you for entertaining such diverse questions. Thank you, Benjamin, for sending us entertaining questions.
Yeah, this is an interesting issue. There are all these products that are out there that have been sold for as long as I can remember, as long as I've been in business, that you could buy these powdered inoculum of mycorrhiza to shake the seeds in before putting them in the ground. And this was to enhance the growth on the roots and enhance the fixation of nitrogen and so on. Every .edu site I've ever looked at on this topic pretty much says you don't need to do this. Obviously, the manufacturers of these products would disagree with that. But the evidence just isn't in that it's necessary. And you're right, they are already in the soil. They should already be present in the soil unless something was done. You know, I've talked about this on nursery Facebook groups and people reply, well, what about where they've stripped off all the topsoil and then brought back in fill? And I thought, well, they're probably in the fill. I don't know. Does it hurt? All right, it gets back to our key question that I adopted from Dr. Linda Chakra Scott at Washington State University. When asked about any product or practice, two questions: is it necessary? Is it harmful? I don't think it's necessary ever to put mycorrhiza on the roots of anything you're putting in the soil. I have seen no evidence to indicate that, despite all the products in the marketplace, from mycorrhiza to put on tree roots when you're planting them and beans and whatnot. So I don't think it's necessary. Is it harmful? Probably not. But Benjamin raises one interesting question, which I've only seen discussed a couple of times. Is it possible to negatively disrupt native soil microbial ecosystems by introducing competitors? And the answer is, yeah, it could be. I've only ever seen one or two studies on this, but I remember discussion actually with the author of Understanding Roots, Robert Couric, who had looked into this a little bit, and other sites where I've looked at it. You could be, if they establish, you could be affecting the population of native microbes. My understanding of soil microbial ecosystems is that they tend to come back into balance pretty quickly. So turning this stuff in or shaking the seeds in it and putting it in, if there's a disruption of the native soil microbes, it probably is short term. But that does give a more ambiguous answer to the is it harmful part of the two-part question we always ask, right? Is it necessary? No. Is it harmful? Probably not. Where does that leave you with the decision to purchase it? I wouldn't. I've never used them. I don't bother. I don't think they're necessary. You might be in a situation where your soil is so deficient in the naturally occurring mycorrhiza that it would be beneficial, although you would want to ask yourself, why is your soil so deficient in the naturally occurring mycorrhiza? Could it be that you just need to get more organic content in there by mulching regularly, which will always enhance the presence of microbes? Could it be that you need to be irrigating in less of a deficit manner? In other words, very dry soils are less likely to sustain microbes in the rhizosphere than soils that are adequately irrigated. So I would look more at the overall environment, as we always do, than at the particular gap in the presence of these mycorrhiza. I just don't think they're necessary. I don't think they're harmful in most cases. It's possible that they could be in some, and there certainly needs to be more research done on that. I doubt if you're hurting much if you apply them. Let's put it that way.
So if you were planting in a planter or a raised bed that is separated from the soil below it,
right,
and
you're
putting in bagged things as your soil, now they wouldn't have any mycorrhiza, would they?
Yes, of course they do. Yes,
potting, they do.
Every soil does.
Oh. Everything,
every potting soil you buy, it all has microbes in it, unless it's been literally sterilized. And no soils that you buy are literally sterilized. The only question is whether they have the appropriate environment to sustain the growth of those things.
Uh-huh.
They've gone very, very, very dry, for example, or if they've been composted to an internal temperature of 140 to 150 degrees. So a true compost might not have them, but they would probably restore, reestablish very quickly. This is the point I'm making, is that they tend to come back into their appropriate balance for your climate, your situation. The way to encourage soil microbes is to just have a steady supply of the things that they feed on. And one of the simplest things, and even moisture distribution. So one of the simplest things you can do, we always come back to this, mulch, 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 mulch. Any of you, by the way, total digression for a moment, read the New Yorker magazine. They did a feature on Ruth Stout this week. Which
really?
Is indeed. You know who Ruth Stout is.
Of course.
Yes, the no-till garden guru of the 1950s. Ruth Stout had been gardening since the 30s or 40s. It's a fascinating profile on her. She's kind of come back into fashion. And her, if you want to take all of her books and summarize them into like two sentences, mulch heavily all the time with whatever you got. Pretty much what it comes down to. Don't turn, don't pull, don't, you know, it's kind of, we've adopted a lot of this over the years. Don't, no-till is standard now. Cut things off instead of pulling them out, you know, so the roots can break down. Anything you've got can go on the garden. She liked to joke, I guess, the trashier your garden looks, the more, you know, effectively you're mulching. If those leaves come down in the fall, why aren't you putting them on your vegetable garden? If you've got junk from your summer vegetable garden, why aren't you leaving it out there? That's basically her bottom line. Well, you're helping all of those microbes, all those mycorrhiza, just have a healthier environment. You're not necessarily directly feeding them. You're just making an environment where they can flourish better. So that would be my approach to dealing with soil mycorrhiza.
So, Don, I have a document in front of me called Blooming Now. And you sent it fairly recently, so I think these things might still be blooming.
These are all blooming right now. These were questions that we've had or pictures that have been sent to us about things that are in bloom in the Davis area. And they're often things that people either didn't recognize or were surprised how many there are. Let's put it that way. And the first one on the list is...
Redbud.
Redbuds.
Lots of Western redbud around here at the Quaker Meeting House, which is, I took pictures last Sunday, and there was like 20 different kinds of flowers out there. But we have three different kinds of redbuds there. We've got the Western, we've got the Canadensis, and then is it the Turkish? Is that the third one?
So this is the question we're getting. Are these all the same plant? And the answer is no. There are two very common red buds in the Davis area and increasingly around Sacramento Valley and probably other parts of California. The native Western red bud, which technically wouldn't be native literally right here, but very close. It's native to the bathtub ring, as I like to say. The bathtub ring being the plant ecosystems just around the valley floor. You know, if you're driving Interstate 80, Interstate 50, you don't see the red buds until you've just gone up a little ways. It's just getting up towards the foothills. Then you see tons of them. And you see lots of them around Davis. They didn't happen naturally. They were planted. Cirsus occidentalis, the Western redbud, there's a whole grove of them in the Arboretum named after Warren Roberts, former a retired superintendent. And there's a lot of them planted in people's gardens. If it's a shrub, it's probably the Western redbud. If it has multiple trunks coming from the base and a somewhat angular outward growth habit, Cirsus occidentalis. And by the way, occidentalis just means Western. But you're also seeing a large number of the Oklahoma redbud, which is, here's my favorite plant name, although I'm sure it's been changed, Cirsus canadensis texensis cultivar Oklahoma.
Okay. Wait a minute. Cirsus, that's redbud. Canadensis is Canada. Texansis is Texas. Yep. Oklahoma's in the middle.
Yep. It's all those things. So Oklahoma redbud, the color is exactly the same. I mean, slight variation in the shades of magenta pink, basically. If it looks like a tree, it's the Oklahoma redbud. If it looks like a bush, it's the Western redbud. You can pretty much go with that because the Western redbud is rarely trained as a single trunk tree and should not be trained as a single trunk tree because of its propensity towards dieback. I've had this experience and many of my customers have had the experience of planting a Western redbud, watching it grow for 3 to 5 years, and then one whole side of the plant will die abruptly. Customer just came in the other day. We talked about this last year. Now her whole plant has died. It does happen. In her case, looks, sounds like verticillium wilt. There's also anthracnose, which can hit the foliage. But in particular, you can get a whole branch infected in a wet winter when we have a lot of splashing rain, as we did the last couple of years, El Nino years, where it infects a branch above ground and that whole branch dies, but that's it. The rest of the plant looks perfectly healthy. Happened to one of my favorite Western redbuds along my driveway a couple of years ago in a wet winter. I cut that branch out. Fine. The plant is now fine, but it can always happen again. So I strongly recommend not ever planting a Western redbud in a single trunk tree form, because if it happens to get infected on that single trunk, you're going to have to start over completely. Whereas if it gets infected on one branch, you just prune that out, the plant will rebalance itself. Oklahoma redbud, which is a variety of the Eastern redbud, Cirsus canadensis, is unique in that group. It's a very thick-leafed redbud with a shiny, waxy leaf coating. So our experience is it takes heat very well. It looks better in the summer even than the Western redbud because that thicker leaf resists the heat stress. It naturally is a tree and is easily trained into a single trunk form. So the city of Davis and Tree Davis have been planting lots of Oklahoma redbuds. It's a nice small tree for a front yard where you don't have room for a big shade tree or for a patio or something like that. A lot of the places people were planting crepe myrtles were steering them towards the Oklahoma redbud because it doesn't get the aphid problem that the crepe myrtles get. It's a similar scale of tree. Biggest difference, it blooms now. And the crepe myrtles, of course, bloom in the summer. But the Oklahoma redbud is becoming very, very popular. And I would say as you're driving around now, It's about 50-50. I was looking at the list of trees that Tree Davis has been planting for the city of Davis for the last 2 years, and it's the number one choice. Because in a lot of situations, people don't want a great big shade tree. So we're doing a lot of Oklahoma redbuds. And it's going to be a very lovely canopy as we, you know, get them all over town blooming at this time of year each year. The other eastern redbuds, unfortunately, forest pansy, there's a bunch of cultivars. They're much thinner leafed. They just fry in the summer here. And it's the same species, Cirsus canadensis. They're just other cultivars within that species. Oklahoma is unique. The others I do not recommend for the valley or hot interior parts of Southern California or any place like that where you have high temperatures and low humidity. Stick to Cirsus occidentalis if you want a shrub and you're okay with managing the occasional dieback problem. Cirsus canadensis, Texensis, Oklahoma, if you want a tree that has the same kind of flower.
Are all red buds from North America or no. Are there red buds elsewhere? Because I think we have, could we have a Turkish red bud?
There is an Afghan red bud. Story of that one. One of my employees, with permission, went over and gathered seed from the one on campus. The one on campus, which is near the Arboretum teaching headquarters, was grown from seeds that were brought to the Arboretum by my business partner in the 1970s.
Wow.
Yeah. Before I knew him. So he donated those seeds to he was stationed in Afghanistan with his business and gathered the seeds there. It's native. There are the Judas tree is a type of redbud. So they're native to the Mediterranean. They're native to parts of Europe. They're native, obviously, to Afghanistan. That's Cirsus griffithi. We've grown them from seed. They sprouted quite readily. We'll see how well that one does in this area. So generally speaking, they are the ones we deal with are from drier climates. Canadensis, the eastern redbud, is from a rainier, is from a milder summer temperature, higher humidity climate. So the Oklahoma is the only one in that group we would look at. But we are considering trying some of the ones from other regions because we need more genetic diversity. You don't want one variety of tree to be everywhere. You want to start getting more diversity in there. Anyway, that was redbuds. They're blooming right now. You can't miss them around town.
So blooming right now, we have my Rosa banksia has just started. It's going to be in full bloom in a week. It's just incredible.
Yeah, people have been sending me pictures because there's a couple in rather visible places. We talk about this one a lot on the show because it's just a cool plant that does this once a year, 3 week bloom, and then that's it. I mean, that's one thing to be aware of. This is not a rose like you're thinking of, like traditional roses. There are three forms of Rosa banksia in the trade and one imposter. The three forms of Rosa banksia that are in the trade, I have, well, this one is not really Rosa banksia normalis, which is the single petaled white Rosa banksia. Yeah. Smells strongly of violets, very, very strongly of violets for about an hour and a half each evening. My plant goes about 50 feet down a fence, about 40 feet up an old pecan tree, and it's in spectacular bloom now and has been for about 2 weeks. And you can smell the blossoms 200-400 yards away. As we get to sunset, this is a plant that releases its volatile organic compounds only at a particular time of day. You walk up to the flower midday, you can smell it, but you're not going to get it 10 feet away. However, in early evening, it is astonishingly fragrant. Some people describe it as cotton candy. It reminds me of the violet pastel candies that people would eat. Some people think it smells like violet flowers. It's that kind of a sweet smell. The second to bloom in general is the yellow one, which is Rosa banksia lutea, which has got a double flower and also is quite fragrant, slightly different smell to it, a little bit more like cotton candy, a little bit less like violets if you want to get into those distinctions. The third one, and mine has just started to bloom, is a double flowered white one, Rosa banksia alba plena. And that's probably the most common in the trade. It's got the showier flowers and a lighter fragrance, but it's got a longer bloom for about 4 weeks and they're brighter. They're just more pizzazz to the flowers. So it's become the most popular. So Rosa banksia alba plena is what you're likeliest to find in garden centers. I think the yellow one is more elegant. I personally think the single petaled one is even more elegant. But the only way you're going to get one of those is if you ask me to take a cutting of it, because nobody grows that in the wholesale nursery trade. Heinz Wholesale Nurseries about 40 years ago introduced a hybrid between Rosa banksia and Rosa bracteata, which is the mermaid rose. I'm pretty sure that's what the parentage is. And they gave it some other name, and it's got a twice the size flower, and it keeps blooming all summer long. So that's really cool, right? It's one of the thorniest roses I've ever seen. Rosa banksia basically has almost no prickles. I mean, there's here and there, but for the most part, if you're having to prune your Lady Banks rose, it's not a painful experience. If you have to prune this thing, it's extremely painful. Any of you in Southern California know the mermaid rose? That's Rosa bracteata. That's what this was crossed with. So if you want a Lady Banks rose, make sure it doesn't have thorns. And if you want a true Lady Banks rose, look for one of the three that I mentioned, Normalis, Lutea, or Albaplana, and avoid the one with the thorns.
So as soon as it finishes flowering, this plant, and I have had a Lady Banks rose for years, this plant will throw out side shoots that I swear could be 12 feet long one season.
Oh yeah,
it's amazing. So yeah. So watch where it's going if you don't want to have it and you know get friendly with one of your trees.
Right. That's what it wants to do. It wants it to climb up into trees. If you look through rose books, I'm enjoying reading some old books by David Austin from the 1980s. And I'm always interested in how they categorize roses because it's really challenging to come up with the categories of roses that really explain what they do, especially when you get to climbing roses. There are a lot of climbing roses that are just really stiff, upright, big shrubs, in which case you can work with that. There are some that simply would run across the ground if you did nothing else. So they often call those rambling roses, and you'll take them and you'll train them on a low split rail fence, and it's very elegant and attractive. So those are kind of true climbers, I guess you could say. Well, the really true climbers are some of the species roses, which I would call scramblers, not ramblers, not climbers, scramblers. A Lady Banks rose will easily scramble 50 to 100 feet up into a tree over a house. The biggest one in the world for a long time, I assume it's still there, was in Tombstone, Arizona. At the time I looked it up, it was covering something like 12,000 square feet on an arbor structure. They just kept expanding outward for this one single plant. Very, very large one over on 7th Street, I think it is, in Davis. I was standing there talking to the customer, pointing at the tree that was in bloom. And she said, no, that's not the tree that's in bloom. This trunk, which was easily at least 12-inch diameter, was a roughly 100-year-old Lady Banks rose that was climbing up into the tree. The rose was in bloom. The tree had bloomed previously. So they get very, very large. It's a fun shrub or vine if you have room for it, or scrambler, I guess is the best term for it. But it's a very big plant. Whenever someone orders one, I want to make sure you really got room for this. But if you don't, you're only putting it on one panel of fence and you want to know how to manage that. When it's done blooming, it only blooms once a year and only blooms for a few weeks. You can cut it back as hard as you want. Then these 12-foot things come out that Lois is describing. You train those where you want, or just let them arch out. Those will bloom next year. Then you cut them back again if you want to do that. So it's a pretty easy one to manage if you happen to want to do that. If you don't, I can't even stand in a place on my farm to take a picture of the full scale and dimension of my Lady Banks rose. So 50 feet down a fence, 40 feet up a tree, it's kind of hard to visualize, but it's quite impressive. Okay, what's next on the list?
Well, we have lilacs coming up, and these are the real lilacs. This is not the Ceanothus California lilac. It's the real lilacs. And I got rid of my normal lilac plant, and I now have a split leaf. Oh, I forgot the name. Never mind.
Oh, the Persian lilac? You know, so true lilacs and Ceanothus California or mountain lilacs are also in bloom right now, or coming into bloom, depending on where you are. Some of them have been blooming for a month or more. The French hybrid lilac is what most people are thinking of when they say lilac, but this is another case where common names can become a little confusing. Lilacs are so much beloved, like lilies, like roses, like, let me think of some of the other, jasmine. You know, these are plants that people know broadly, and so if you see something that looks like that, you give it that common name. I've heard native plant purists, if you will, complain about the fact that Ceanothus is called California lilac or mountain lilac. Well, it's called that because it resembles lilac. That's how common names work. They're always misleading. They're intended to give you a similarity that will make it easy for you to remember that plant. So they're both blooming, but people often are surprised to learn that we can grow lilacs here in Northern California in the Sacramento Valley. You know, you can grow lilacs in Southern California. If you're down there and you're listening to us, just look in your local nursery. Hopefully this is what they would be stocking. The Descanso hybrids, which are from Descanso Gardens, which are down there. They will bloom without a significant amount of chilling hours. And so I have some of these. I have one that actually tries to bloom in the fall. It needs so few chilling hours. It's kind of a problem in that regard. But in general, the Descanso hybrids are great choices for Southern California, and most of them are fine for Northern California as well. They're fragrant, but not as powerfully fragrant as the French hybrid lilacs, which is what everyone else is thinking of, and which you can grow evidently all the way up into Canada and places like that. I mean, if I lived in a very, very, very cold climate, I would probably collect lilacs. Why not? They would be, they're one of the easiest things you can grow. Yes, we can grow them here. Regular French hybrid lilacs. I have them in full bloom right now. So if you're listening in another part of the country, that might be a good marker for you as to where you stand with respect to your spring versus our spring. My lilacs begin blooming in late March and bloom through the month of April. So if yours are in May, which I think is more traditional, and blooming into June, then you know that when we're talking about garden aspects, we're probably 4 to 6 weeks ahead of you at least. Lilacs are in full bloom right now. They're very easy to grow here. They're a plant that actually prefers, believe it or not, slightly alkaline soil, as they say. Well, we've got that. Our water here is somewhat alkaline. You don't need to lime them or anything of that sort, but people certainly will go out of their way to pamper them. Don't bother. Lilacs can just go in regular garden soil. They don't need anything special with respect to soil conditions or fertilizer. You prune them just for size control if you want to do that. If you don't do it, I can guarantee from experience they'll get 10 to 15 feet. So you might want to bring them down after the bloom, just like the Lady Banks rose, prune right after the bloom for size control. And that's it. And just give them as much sun. This is the key thing. As much sun as possible. They will grow and bloom in the shade, but the plants will get mildew. And the plants will look a lot better if they get full sun. Some people are wondering whether they can really take our full hot summer sun conditions here. Yes, we bought this property. There were lilacs on here that were getting no care whatsoever, and they were doing fine. So I just kept planting more. And my experience is that French hybrid lilacs do very well in Northern California. Descanso hybrids, great for Southern California and also Northern California.
My lilacs always had a mildew problem. Yep. Are there any that are more resistant to it, or is it just don't put them in any shade?
I'm sure there are. There are hundreds of varieties of lilacs, and I've just never found that information. So my experience is that just putting them in full sun is probably your best bet. They'll still bloom. Yours probably bloomed for you. I have one that was planted in full sun, and as often happens on my property, it's now in considerable shade because I planted trees near it. It still grows. It blooms. I have pictures of it every spring in full bloom. And then by midsummer, the leaves are covered with white powder. I've thought about taking it out, but I really don't need the spot for something else. It wouldn't be very satisfactory to someone with a smaller yard. The more sun, the better. More air movement, the better. Other than that, they're very, very easy to grow here.
Can it be transplanted? Can you pluck it from its shady spot and put it in a sunny spot?
Anything in theory can be transplanted. If I were doing that, I would do it in the fall or the winter.
Okay. Because they do go dormant. They definitely go dormant.
Yes.
So I want to talk about California poppies.
They are blooming like crazy.
Yep. Incredibly all over. And I'm going, how did they get that? And then I realized, oh, these are the ones that got planted in the fall. They started up, they hunkered down, and now they're coming out. If you planted them in the spring, you're not going to get it now.
We sell California poppy seed year round because people think about them. They want to plant them year round. There's two things that can happen. If you scatter the seed going into warm weather, they will probably come up, a lot of it, but not all of it. You'll need to water it, obviously, water the seedlings if they do sprout. And there's a long period with California poppies of the little delicate little seedling down there just doing nothing and then all of a sudden expanding like crazy. If you do them now, they probably have time to bloom late May, early June. I don't know if they have time to set seed pods and scatter themselves. That's a big question. Some of the seed will just lie there and wait until fall, assuming it doesn't get covered and it doesn't get buried in something. It could come up with the first rains or when you start irrigating in late summer, early fall. Poppy seed needs to not be covered in order to germinate. We mentioned that in the fall when we talk about it. So the very best time to plant poppy seed is right before a rainstorm, anytime between about the 1st of October and early to mid-December. But you can throw the seed out pretty much anytime. And if you've got enough of it, something is sure to grow. I've occasionally had customers who complain they can't get poppies to establish, and they probably have a garden it's too orderly, too tidy, too well-maintained, and they don't have an open soil area where they can just throw the seed and let it develop. For those folks, I suggest just plant, you know, buy and plant a plant. Nurseries do sell California poppies in 4-inch pots. Even some of them sell them in gallon containers. Seems a little odd, but two things. One, California poppy is really a short-lived perennial, not an annual. It is very easy to get a single California poppy plant to grow for 2 or 3 years and continue blooming. I learned this years ago that I learned it from Caltrans, basically. Caltrans is our transportation department, which mows the grassy weeds along the verge, along the sides of the freeways as we get into the hotter, drier weather. And in many places, they have poppies blooming amongst the grasses, and they would go along in May and even June, and they would mow the grasses down to prevent fire, but their mowers are set up at about 4 inches. So that mows off the poppies, but leaves the crown down at the base. Very commonly, if the weather is mild, those plants will continue to bloom. They'll throw out some more blooms into the early summer. And even more commonly, since they've mowed the grasses and taken away all the competition pretty much for the summer, those plants will come back into bloom in the fall, especially as we start getting into rainy weather. So the plant can function as a perennial, but more to the point, if you have difficulty getting the seedlings to germinate on your property, plant a plant in a place where there's nice open soil around it, nurture it, let it bloom, let it shatter its seed pods and scatter itself. And if there's open soil, you'll have a full carpet of seedlings when the rains begin. And I have found from experience, well, poppies are notorious for being difficult to transplant. They have fragile roots. I can take a trowel when the soil is moist. Let's say we've had 1 to 2 inches of rain and there's a nice carpet of seedlings, and I stick the trowel down. I get a little clump of seedlings and I walk over a couple feet and I make a hole and put them right back in and water them immediately. I've had good results doing that. Transplanting them out of containers is a little dicier because those roots tend to break off in your hand, but you can transplant the seedlings out from a seedling bed very, very carefully. And over time, if you have open areas, the poppies will fill them. On my property, they mostly go right along the gravel driveway, right on the edge. They don't grow in the bed because there's too much competition in there, but they love the edge of the bed where the gravel driveway is. So you have to tolerate a little more informal look to your yard to have poppies naturalizing, but it's pretty easy to do once you get that first plant going.
So the poppies that I am familiar with are a bright, solid gold color. Mm-hmm. They're a yellow gold. And then that same plant later on in the season will have poppies that are colored slightly differently. They're like almost two-tone. They have the gold fading into the yellow and such like that. But it's the same plant.
Well, it may be the same plant. It may be a different plant that just popped it. But color of flowers is affected by temperature more than anything. So that's the primary difference. But there are some subspecies. If you're doing a revegetation project, for example, with native plants, it would be important to not just assume that any casual pack of California poppy seeds is going to give you what you need. Let's say you've got some property in the Oakland Hills or something, and you're trying to replant the grasses and the flowers that would have actually been there, you should probably find out what the subspecies is of the California poppy, Eschscholzia californica, that would have truly been there. And you can source that from native plant experts such as Hedgerow Farms, Theodore Payne Foundation. Get the appropriate poppy to where you're listening to us or where you're planting. For a home gardener in the backyard, you're probably just planting the regular bright orange one, and the flower color can vary. And it can vary with seedlings within a batch of seed can vary somewhat, and you can get two-tone flowers. And of course, there are garden hybrids out there. We sell them. Mission Bells is a beautiful one that has all kinds of interesting red and pink and white in with the orange. You can plant that, and as it reseeds, as successive generations come along, gradually the percentage of the population that's that normal orange will increase until that's basically all you have. So they will revert to type over several generations. You will find hybrid California poppy strains on the seed racks as well.
So these are California poppies, and they are not bulbs. They are plants. Yep. What about other things that are called poppies? The China poppies, the
Flanders whatever. Poppy. Oh yeah, there's all kinds of poppies. We've had fun growing them. One of the experiments that has been ongoing at my garden center for over 5 years now is finding things that are not common in garden centers and seeing if it's possible to grow them in a form that people can transplant. And we went through a phase of the various Oriental poppies, as they call them, various of the things like Flanders poppy, Shirley poppy. Almost all of them proved to be very problematic in terms of growing them for sale. I can say that because they almost all develop a taproot that's very fragile. So growing poppies to sell them to the public to plant out in their gardens is very challenging. But there are a lot of others, and almost all of them in our area are best fall planted. So if you like the Oriental poppy with the massive bloom, the various things like the Hungarian bread seed poppy, the Danish flag poppy, which is just an amazing one. These are plants you put in October. You watch this huge plant develop, and then you get this bloom now, March, April, May, depending on the variety. And it's not a lot of flowers, but usually they're 5 or 6 inches across, so they're unbelievably spectacular. And then you can save the seed of those and either let them scatter themselves or carefully plant them next fall. Poppies in general are very, very easy to grow, especially in our climate where they dry off properly and don't rot as we go into the season when the seed head would be forming. So it's an easy group of plants to work with. And the only difficulty we've had is it's really challenging to grow them in a way that you can buy. So you generally have to do them from seed.
What about Iceland poppies? Are those really poppies?
There's an exception, yes. Papaver nudicauli. And it's not from Iceland, just for the record. So another case of a very misleading common name. But Iceland poppies are sold as perennials in many parts of the country. They're definitely annual, function as annuals here because they don't take the heat. But they're great to plant midwinter for bloom, late winter and spring. And then they're done when hot weather comes. And I've personally never had them go through the summer. There's a lot of plants that we sell as annuals. Pansies, violas, snapdragons, Iceland poppies, things like that, because they're killed by heat, not because they're truly a functioning annual that grows flowers, seeds, and dies, but because they simply can't survive our summers. There are places where those are probably perennial, but Iceland poppies give spectacular bright yellow, orange, white flowers that sort of float above the foliage. There's no leaves on the stem, hence the species name nudicauli, which literally means naked stem. And so the flowers are sort of bobbing in the air above the foliage, and they're lovely plants. Best planted in the cool season, they'll be done by about the end of May.
Yeah.
Okay, we had an interesting question about bamboo.
We do. John from Fair Oaks writes, "Hi, Don and Lois, knowing that Don is a fan of bamboo." Well, now let's clarify that. Don's mother was a bamboo expert.
My parents, my mother and I edited the magazine of the American Bamboo Society together for 12 years, and I continued for another 5. So we became experts just by being editors.
All right.
We published a lot of really cool articles by experts, let's put it that way. But yes, I'm also a fan of bamboo. I have lots of bamboo.
And John writes, "I'm hoping that Don can help me. My bamboo has largely turned yellow and defoliated. Yeah. Looking closely, it seems that it may have flowered. Will it recover? Or is my only option to replace it? It's a running bamboo in a container. I don't remember what kind. Thank you."
Yes, and those are pictures of flowers. So your bamboo is flowering, and it's undoubtedly a phyllostachys, which are the best known of the running bamboos. Bamboos are generally categorized as running or clumping. And the running bamboos, like phyllostachys, when they flower, die. Not every time, not every species, but that's the general pattern. My mother used to collect the flowering records of bamboo, and she happened to have a bunch of them, and it got known in the American Bamboo Society and then the various bamboo societies around the world that she was doing this and that she and I were editors of the magazine. So people would send her flowering records if they had anytime a bamboo was coming into flower. And when the proprietors and managers of Kew Gardens in the UK discovered that my mother was managing these records, they sent her 200 years of their own flowering records. So she carefully compiled all of that as well. So she put together a long Word document. Mom was not super computer savvy, about the flowering of all the different bamboos. And that information is available to the American Bamboo Society. And what we can tell you is that gregarious flowering bamboos, which are ones that flower all at once, when a particular species comes into flower on a 30-year, 60-year, 100 plus year cycle, all of the plants of that clone, which are often all of the plants around the world because of the nature of the bamboo nursery industry, will come into flower everywhere, and then they will flower and seed and die. Bad news for you if you own the bamboo. Great news if you're a bamboo nursery, because now you have seed, and seed of bamboo is quite rare. So you have seed and it's easy to grow, and you grow seedlings. And now of the seedlings, you'll find some with striped leaves and some with darker leaves and some with striped canes. And all of a sudden you can name a bunch of new cultivars, and you'll go safely the next 30, 60, 120 years before that particular clone is going to bloom. Two things. Not all bamboo dies when it flowers. Many of the members of Bambusa, which are clumping bamboos, will flower and not die. My parents had a giant timber bamboo, Bambusa old hammy, on their property in San Diego from the 1950s. It would flower off and on a lot, just in response to stress, apparently. It didn't show any problem with the plant at all. It certainly didn't die, nor was the seed viable, interestingly. But it is the case that many running bamboos, particularly Phyllostachys, Bambusoides in the 1970s, Phyllostachys nigra over the last 5 to 10 years, they start to flower. This is big news to bamboo people. Oh my God, the black bamboo is flowering. And that's one that has done so. Once that news gets out there, if you're selling black bamboo, you should stop doing so. And you should monitor your plants. And once they flower, that plant is going to almost certainly die. They rarely come back from the flowering episode. So it's a fascinating subject. There's a lot of theories about why they are on these long, multi-decadal bloom cycles. And I've published articles on that topic. If you're interested, I can send them to you as a PDF. Just send a note to davisgardenshow@gmail.com, and I'll send you the whole overview of why bamboo flowers on multi-decadal cycles and what the theories are. But once you got one blooming, that plant's going to die. And the answer to your basic question is, yep, time to get a new one, and not the same species. Also check when you're buying bamboo, particularly right now, Phyllostachys nigra, the black bamboo, very popular, very vigorous spreader, but also beautiful black culms, black stems, has been blooming for 7 or 8 years, and they're all dying. So if your nursery sells you one that's in bloom or coming into bloom, they kind of ripped you off. I hate to say that.
Well, we're going to end our garden show today with a quote from one of our favorite people, Fred Hoffman. You know Fred, don't you?
Yeah, he has a great podcast, and I'm on it periodically.
And his quote is, all gardening is local. We joke and spell it L-O-C-O, but it really is local, as in regional.
All gardeners are loco. All gardening is local. There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
This is a message that came from the DJ at Yolo County Breakdown, who goes by the name Rocky Outcrop. And Rocky says, I have two extremely exciting special guests coming up on Yolo County Breakdown that I would love to get promoted on your shows. You bet, Rocky. Here we go. On Friday, March 28th, Rocky will be joined by the undisputed heavyweight champion of the banjo world, Bella Fleck. Any of you out there know who this man is? You're already jumping up and down going, oh my God, on a radio program in Little Davis, California. Bella
in
Fleck.
In person?
In person is a genre-defying master of the banjo, one of the most honored musicians in the history of the Grammy Awards with 19 wins spanning bluegrass, country, pop, jazz, classical, and world music genres. Bella Fleck's impact on banjo playing cannot be overstated, as he took the Earl Scruggs style and expanded into musical universes without boundaries. His latest album, which is set to be released on May 16th, is his first foray into Latin jazz and teams him up with virtuoso Colombian harpist Edmar Castaneda and Mexican drummer Antonio Sanchez. They call themselves Beat Trio. And then on Friday, April 4th, I'll have my first ever guest, who is a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. We got some heavyweights here. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Jorma Kaukonen. Jorma is an icon of 1960s rock and roll and a member of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna. And they will be on Yolo County Breakdown. So to find the timing of that show, just go to the schedule guide at kdrt.org.